A distant world wanders the galaxy, and Planet Vac heads into space this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. So much to share with you today. We'll talk with astronomer Radek Pilecki, whose team has used relativity to discover an Earth-sized planet that is nearly a quarter of the way across the Milky Way. Then we'll turn to Chris Zackney of Honeybee Robotics, along with our own Bruce Betts, to learn how the radically simple gas-driven sample collection system called PlanetVac will soon head for the Moon and Mars. Planetary Society CEO Bill Nye will share some thoughts too, and it's a signed copy of Bill's newest book that someone will soon win in the What's Up Space Trivia contest, Bruce will announce. That pale blue dot where we all live tops the November 6th edition of the Downlink. You'll find these stories, among others, below it, beginning with word that there may be as many as 300 million habitable planets in our own galaxy alone. We've also learned that the European Space Agency's little Philae lander, carried to Comet 67P by Rosetta, tumbled through ancient surface ice that was, and I'm quoting, fluffier than cappuccino froth. And if you want to see how our solar system's biggest worlds may have migrated outward from much closer to the sun, well, we've got the video at planetary.org/downlink. I learned a remarkable thing a couple of weeks ago. An international team led from the University of Warsaw in Poland announced that it had discovered an exoplanet. Did I hear you say, so what? Or maybe you agree with me that the discovery of any world is worthy of celebration. But this one is wandering the galaxy on its own, tens of thousands of light years from Earth. And we can once again thank Albert Einstein's insights for enabling its discovery. Astronomer Radek Pilecki is one of the leaders of that team. He joined me from Warsaw a few days ago. You'll hear a couple of references to OGLE. That's OGLE, or the Optical Gravitational Lensing Experiment. Dr. Pilecki, welcome to Planetary Radio, and congratulations on this nearly miraculous discovery of this little world that is off floating across the Milky Way all by itself. We're glad to have you on with us on Planetary Radio.
Good afternoon.
Before we talk about how you and this team made this amazing discovery, I'd like to hear more about this lonely little world. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so you said the most important part, meaning it's lonely. So we found a planet that seems to be just a single planet that is not orbiting any star. Like Earth orbits the sun, this little planet seems to have no star around it. So it's just a single planet. There's nothing more, really.
I have read that our current understanding of planet formation and what happens in solar systems indicates that this single example may be just one of, what, millions across our galaxy?
I'm pretty sure there are more such planets in the galaxy. It's very hard to find them. So we found one that has very small mass, and I'm almost sure there are planets with smaller masses. We have just a few such objects that we currently know, and we know that it's very hard to discover them, so the real number must be much, much higher.
Do we know how far away this world is?
We know it's closer than the galactic bulge, that's for sure, because we detected the planet in a very rare phenomenon that is called gravitational microlensing. And microlensing happens when the light of the background, more distant source of light, travels next to a massive object, in this case, a planet, and the gravity of the planet bends the light rays. The effect of that is that we receive more light from the source. And in this case, as is the case for most of the microlensing events, the source is in the galactic bulge, so 8.5 kiloparsecs from us, 25-something thousand light years from us. And for sure, we know that the lens, meaning the planet that we found, is closer to us. Most probably, it's around 6,000 parsecs away.
And what would that be in light years? Do you know offhand?
Around 20,000.
Absolutely amazing to think that not only has this world, which I've read is maybe just the size of our own, of Earth, could be found at that kind of distance. And we'll talk more about gravitational lensing in a moment. So when you say on this side of the galactic bulge, that's largely because it's so difficult to see through that bulge, which is basically the core of our galaxy. Is that correct?
Microlensing is a very rare phenomenon, so because we need a source and the lens and us as an observer to be aligned almost exactly at one straight line. So if you observe a million stars for a year, then most probably you will see only a single case of microlensing. So we observe galactic bulge because that's the place on the sky where we can see lots of stars. And then we see the microlensing events where the sources are the stars in the galactic bulge, and the lenses can be either in the galactic bulge or in the galactic disks, slightly closer.
I see. Before we leave this world, I have to ask, is it crazy to talk about whether a rogue planet like this could be habitable? Yes, that does sound like a crazy question, but then I think of someplace like the moon Enceladus at Saturn, which has liquid water inside it. It was thought for years to be far too small for that. It's fairly distant from Saturn, so it's not hugely influenced by Saturn's gravity, as is a world like Europa and Jupiter. Do you think that this is even worth talking about, whether it is a habitable world, or is that a real possibility?
For sure it's worth talking about. It's, I would say, very important scientific question, and it's important not only to scientists, but for the society as a whole. The problem is that it's very hard to verify if there's any possibility of light on this planet or not. We don't know that much about the planet. What we can say, though, is that there are two main mechanisms that could produce this object. So first of all, this object could be formed in a similar way as stars form, meaning a collapse of a single cloud of gas. It just happened that this one has smaller mass than the stars, very small mass in this case. So that's one possibility. The other is that this planet was ejected from a planetary system that had more planets, and these planets were orbiting a star. In this case, in this second scenario, it's possible that some forms of life started on the planet while it was orbiting its star, and then when the planet was ejected due to gravitational interactions between planets, then the life still survived for some time. It's hard to say, much more than that, but for sure we would like to know the answer to the questions you're posing.
It is a stunning possibility. We have talked about gravitational lensing several times in the past on our show, usually in terms of revealing giant structures like galaxies that formed very early in the history of the universe. I was very surprised to learn that it could work with something as small as a planet. And from what you have said, the gravitational lens, in this case, may have been another planet, something no bigger or roughly in the same size range as the planet that has been revealed?
Yes. All the time I'm talking about gravitational microlensing. And microlensing means that the additional images that are formed are so close to each other that we cannot separate them on images taken from the ground or from Hubble Space Telescope. We just see that we're receiving more flux from the source than we should have if there was no microlensing. Such events happen in the galactic scales, and that's why we observe the galactic bulge. Currently, we detect more than 2,000 microlensing events per year. A small percentage of those shows not only that there's the main lensing object, which is a star in most cases, but also some additional object, which in some cases happens to be a planet. In this case, we see extremely short microlensing event. So this event, the timescale of the event was 42 minutes.
Wow.
So it's something extremely short, really. And over these 42 minutes, the whole event happened. If you compare that to the galaxy lensing about which we talked before, then these galactic lenses don't change. They slightly change over our lifetime, but they're extremely similar from one epoch to another. Here we have something completely different and completely different observing strategy. We don't need huge telescopes. We need moderate size telescopes, but with large cameras, with big field of view, so that we can see many stars at a time, and then use that to study lots of stars, and from those stars to search for these very rare microlensing events.
I have just one other question for you, and it's about the institution where you work. It would appear that the University of Warsaw has been at this work with OGLE and the gravitational microlensing for many years, and that the university is a real leader in this field. How did you become involved?
Poland is my home country, so I was born in Poland, and when I was choosing the university to which I'll go, somebody told me that Warsaw is the best place in Poland to study astronomy, and I think it was true. I did my master's and PhD in Warsaw. During my master's studies, I started to be involved in the OGLE project. When I started PhD, I was involved in observing, so I've been to Las Campanas Observatory many times. I've spent more than 500 nights on the mountain and the telescope altogether during my life. So it's quite a long time, I would say. After doing PhD, I went to Ohio State University, where also the study of microlensing phenomenon is very well established. And I met people who were more involved in analysis of the data and running other projects. So I got a good understanding of data analysis, some aspect of data analysis there. I stayed there a few years and then I went back to Poland. So yes, I'm involved in the OGLE project for 11 years now. So it's a big part of my life.
That's a lot of time you've spent at the telescope site at Las Campanas. I've also been up high there in northern Chile, up in the Atacama. It's quite a beautiful place in its own way, isn't it?
Yes, it's beautiful, and it's beautiful for astronomers. So at the Las Campanas Observatory, the Giant Magellan Telescope is being built right now, which shows it's one of the best places on the Earth for astronomical observations.
Another telescope that we will be talking about, I'm sure, many more times on this program. Radek, thank you again. Congratulations once again to you and the entire team. All of us, I'm sure, wish you many more discoveries of this sort using gravitational microlensing as the work gets back underway with the OGLE experiment. And I hope that that will happen very soon.
Thank you very much. And I hope we'll find many more fascinating objects, and we'll try to report them.
University of Warsaw astronomer Radek Pileski, one of the discoverers of that lonely, starless world. I'll be back with a whole series of stars, beginning with Bill Nye, right after this break.
What a year it has been for space exploration. Hi, I'm Sarah, Digital Community Manager for the Planetary Society. Will you help us celebrate 2020's greatest accomplishments? You can cast your votes for the most stunning image, the most exciting mission, the most surprising discovery, and more at planetary.org/best of 2020. We've also got special year-end content on our social media channels. Voting is open now at planetary.org/best of 2020.
Hi, I'm Jason Davis, Editorial Director for the Planetary Society. Did you know there are more than 20 planetary science missions exploring our solar system? That means a lot of news happens in any given week. Here's how to keep up with it all. The Downlink is our new roundup of planetary exploration headlines. It connects you to the details when you want to dive deeper. From Mercury to interstellar space, we'll catch you up on what you might have missed. That's the Downlink, every Friday at planetary.org.
Longtime listeners know that we've followed the progress of PlanetVac for many years. Its creator, Honeybee Robotics, learned not long ago that their radically simplified system for collecting loose material from the surface of pretty much any rocky body in the solar system, had been chosen for two upcoming missions, one to the moon and another to distant Phobos, the bigger moon circling Mars. We'll welcome Honeybee Vice President and Director of Exploration Technology Chris Sackney and our Bruce Betts. First, though, here's a couple of minutes with Planetary Society CEO Bill Nye. Bill, we'll be talking to Bruce Betts and Chris Sackney of Honeybee Robotics in moments here, but I wanted to give you a chance to say something about this accomplishment.
So everyone, we pulled this off. We got funding from support from our members to make a more efficient, cheaper way to collect samples from extraterrestrial bodies like the moon and Mars. This is really an advance. We increased the reliability of this, the amount of sample you can get, and we do it all using the free helium that's above the tanks of fuel on these spacecraft. It's just a cool idea, and it took years to get the details right so that it would work reliably, but we've got it, and we've been selected on two missions. So thanks to our members. This is one of the three legs of our, one of the three pillars of our work at the Planetary Society. We advocate, we educate, and we innovate. PlanetVac is an innovation because, you know, the thing that I still want to do while I'm still alive, Matt, is find evidence of life on another world.
Amen.
Whether or not it's there, you have to search for life, evidence of life on Mars. I mean, that's just as logical as it gets. It's exciting, and thanks for asking me about it. When you're in love, you want to tell the world, as Carl Sagan always said. And so I love PlanetVac. Except in space, there's no sound. It's just like that. But there's sound on Mars. There's sound on Mars, doggone it. And we're going to have microphones on Mars after February 18th. And we're going to have a Planet Fest, and it's going to be big fun. And for me, this is all part of the larger idea, the mission of, that's the mission of the Planetary Society, to know the cosmos and our place within it.
I am looking forward to all of that, sharing that with you and our members and everybody else out there. Thank you, Bill. I guess in space, no one can hear you suck. Can I say that?
I guess you did. Carry on.
That's Bill Nye, the CEO of the Planetary Society. Chris Sackney, welcome back to Planetary Radio. It has been a while. Bruce Betts, it hasn't been nearly as long for you, but hey, welcome back as well.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Matt. I'm super excited to be back on your radio show. It was a while. It's been a couple of years.
I couldn't believe that it's also been 2 years. Bruce, was it 2018 that I think you went out there more than once, but that I got to go out and stand behind sandbags and watch PlanetVac on the foot of a mast in space system Zodiac rocket and watched it pull up some Mojave Desert dirt?
Yes, almost completely correct, except that it was Mars simulant, but it was in the Mojave Desert. And yes, it was 2 years ago, and it was big fun watching the rocket flying with PlanetVac and watching PlanetVac work so great.
I still have, I think, a few flakes of melted, reconstituted concrete from underneath the rocket motor. That was very cool.
I still have some of that in my hair. It is so hard to know.
And I still have some of the sample.
Oh, good.
You don't want to give that up. That's going to be worth a lot of money someday.
It's ours.
Chris, speaking of samples, we are primarily here to celebrate this announcement that was made, it's still, as we speak, only about a month ago, that PlanetVac is going to the moon and going to Phobos. Let's talk about the moon first. You're going there courtesy of NASA?
Yes. So let's talk about the moon, right? Both Phobos and our moon are moons. Let's talk about the bigger moon.
Capital M moon.
Capital M moon. This is absolutely thrilling. It's a dream come true. It's just unbelievable how all the pieces came together. And big role, obviously, Planetary Society. The announcement of Eclipse, the commercial lunar payload services. This is a new way of doing business. NASA and public or private industry in the so-called PPP, public-private partnership. This is unbelievable successful venture. You know, bunch of good things that industry provides, a lot of things that NASA provides, each of those sites bring the best to the table. And that's why this partnership works. And CLIPS works. So as part of CLIPS, we were selected to fly Planet Vec to the moon to demonstrate this technology. We're flying to Mare Crisium on a mission called 19D. We do not know who is flying us. In fact, either today or sometime next week, NASA will select one of the 14 CLIPS providers to take us to the moon.
No kidding.
Pretty soon we're going to know.
Let's go ahead and talk about going to Mars. Chris, I read now this lunar mission. This is a technology demo. So whatever sample Planet Vec picks up, I guess it won't be coming home. That's not what's going to happen on JAXA's Martian Moons Exploration or MMX mission. For that one, you should be bringing stuff back, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the primary goal of MMX is to explore both moons and touch down on the surface of Phobos for 2, maybe 3 hours and bring some of the samples back. P-sampler, pneumatic sampler, is one of the two sampling systems that will be deployed. There is another one made by JAXA, or Japanese Aerospace Agency. So it's going to be very robotic intensive mission. For the first time, we're going to be bringing sample not just from Phobos, but also Martian sample. There is plenty of Martian ejecta floating around Martian orbit, and some of the stuff has fallen on the surface of Phobos. So it's going to be not just the first Phobos sample return, but also Mars sample return mission.
Chris, when is MMX supposed to make it back to Earth, returning those samples?
Good question. So we're launching in 24, and we're going to be departing around 26. So 26, 27 timeframe, we should be seeing samples back. They're going to re-enter somewhere in the outback Australia, just like Hayabusa 1 and Hayabusa 2.
You heard there Honeybee Robotics Vice President and Director of Exploration Technology, Chris Zackney. Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the Chief Scientist of the Planetary Society, and as such, in addition to telling us what's up in the night sky, he has some other duties, including going to conferences and representing us, and you did that last week. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. I went to the, well, virtually went to the Apophis Team Minus 9 Years workshop.
Ooh, so 9 years from now, close pass, right? Remind us, how close is the Big Rock going to come?
Big Rock will come closer than our geostationary satellites, so a few Earth radii. It will be visible, looking like a third magnitude, so fairly bright star passing across the sky if you're in the right half of the world, which would be Europe and Africa and Western Asia.
What's up there right now? We don't have to wait 9 years to see.
A bunch of asteroids if you have big telescopes. But otherwise, bunch of planets if you have decent eyesight and no clouds. Jupiter and Saturn still hanging out in the southwest in the early evening, Jupiter being the much brighter one. On the 18th of November, the crescent moon will join them for a lovely little triplet. And then we've got Mars up in the evening as well, over in the towards the east, the southeast, and it's still looking super bright, but it is fading gradually as Earth and Mars get farther away. And then in the pre-dawn sky, dominating the east, is super bright Venus. We've also got an apparition of Mercury going on right now below Venus to its lower left, Mercury looking like a bright star, not nearly as bright as Venus, but always low to the horizon. So get a clear view to the eastern horizon in the pre-dawn. You can see Venus and below it Mercury. And if you look on the 13th of November, you will see a moon hanging out. It's our moon. It's the moon, just to be clear. Let us go on to this week in space history. There was some significant, a lot of stuff happened. I'll mention just a couple of them that are having factors of 10 anniversaries. 50 years ago this week, Lunokhod 1 became the first rover on another world, on the moon in 1970. 10 years later, so 40 years ago, Voyager 1 did its flyby of Saturn.
Good ones, yeah.
All right, on to 4, 3, 2, 1, random space fact, random space fact. Lavochkin Association of Russia in 1993, they sold Lunokhod 2 and the Luna 21 lander that went along with it at a Sotheby's auction. These are on the moon, to be clear. And for $68,000 US, Richard Garriott bought them. And to my knowledge, still owns them. Richard Garriott, the son of astronaut Owen Garriott, and an astronaut himself as a space tourist, computer gaming entrepreneur, owns Lunokhod 2 and Luna 21.
I hope that somebody hasn't stolen the wheels by the time he gets up there.
Well, even a Lunokhod on blocks is still worth something. And you can always hang out in the trailer park next door.
Yeah, right. Lunar trailer trash. That's it.
All right. Bring us back from this weird place we've gone. Let us take you to the weird place of the trivia contest. As of now, as measured by average diameter, or equivalently volume, what is the smallest asteroid that has been visited by a spacecraft? How do we do?
Here is our winner. He last won 4.5 years ago. Talk about hanging in there for a second.
Good job.
Yeah. Hudson Ansley in New Jersey, who said, 25143 Itokawa. Congratulations, Hudson. I hope it was worth the wait. You are also going to be waiting a little while at least to pick up a Planetary Society kick asteroid, rubber asteroid. It has not yet been visited by any spacecraft, as far as we know.
But if it were, it would definitely be the smallest. We didn't mention Itokawa, about 350 meters average diameter.
Guess we're ready for another one.
Here's your question. Who named most of the lunar maria with the names that are used today? By which, to be clear, the International Astronomical Union approved names of the maria features on the moon. So who named most of them? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have until the 18th, that'd be November 18th at 8 a.m. Pacific time, to get us the answer. And we have a pretty cool prize for you. Bill Nye has a new book out for kids, 10 and up. It's called Bill Nye's Great Big World of Science. And it's co-authored with Gregory Mohn. We're going to send the winner out there a copy, and it'll be signed by Bill. Not bad, huh? I think it's coming from his personal stash of these books, which just came out just a couple of weeks ago.
Cool.
And that's it.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about how much you'd pay for an old robotic spacecraft on the moon. Thank you, and good night.
You think they'd have taken something in barter? I've got an old drone here that doesn't work, but it, I doubt the rover does anymore either.
Well, you might be able to get one of the crash spacecraft.
That's Bruce Betts. He is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week for What's Up? Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members, rogue and otherwise. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.